meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
Welcome to the Shortcoat Podcast. My name is David Edler, and I'm here with a bunch of people. Got their names, but you know, whatever. Today we're gonna be poking pins in balloons covered in shaving cream, because why not? And we're joined by a special guest named Waffle that loves being on podcasts.
Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast. That was my my son, Aze. He was here in the office earlier this week, wanted to record the show intro using his typical imitation of me, which always, for some reason, involves podcasting.
Well, why the waffles? What?
It's just, that's his go-to fill-in phrase. It's like the lorem ipsum of Aze. So I think he has a future in this business.
Good choice.
Am I right?
Waffles are great.
Yeah.
Waffles belong almost anywhere.
They are delicious. Welcome back to the Shortcoat Podcast, and listeners. And welcome to Mark Mubarak.
Hey, Dave.
Amy Young.
Hello.
Hello. John Pienta.
Hello.
And newcomer Julie Gudenkoff. Did I say that right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
I never say names right. Well, John helped me out this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Welcome to the show. What finally convinced you to be on? You're like a almost a fourth year, for gosh sakes. What?
I met Amy.
I
suck them all in.
Nice.
She invited me, and I couldn't refuse.
Well, I'm glad you're here.
Thanks.
I want to take a minute to remind everybody, all our listeners out there, to send us your questions, comments, and concerns. How many ways are there to do that? Hundreds. You could send us a carrier pigeon, but more efficient, perhaps, are some of the ways listed at theshortcoat.com/tell us. Speaking of which, Mark, on a recent show, we discussed body hair.
Oh, yes, we did.
And I, at the time, I said, sometimes I think about shaving my armpits because I have a theory that it would cut down on the need for deodorant. And you and Aline were like, no, that would never work.
I don't think so.
We didn't say never. We just expressed our criticism.
You poo-pooed.
Concerns about your understanding of where sweat comes from.
I have two comments.
Yeah.
One, why did we not discuss this during the pre-show chat so I knew we were going to talk about this?
Do you feel fully prepared?
Two, what I think it would help with is, like, guys, because they have the hair under their arms when they use deodorant, it, like, really sticks to their under the shirt.
Yes.
And it gets all gross. Ah. And that doesn't happen with women.
Okay.
And
picking.
Yeah, so I think it would help. I think it would help preserve your shirts.
Okay, well, here's a listener with some feedback.
I have some feedback about shaving arms, which was the subject of your last podcast. I am a woman who shaves her armpit, but in the past I didn't shave anything. I had hairy armpits, and it's true that it's easier to maintain a pleasant odor.
I can't believe we're getting back into this.
So sometimes, you know, you get so smelly that you break through that deodorant barrier and you get smelly anyway. Well, that happens much more frequently if you have a big amount of armpit hair.
So, vindicated.
I guess that's the answer.
What a perfect thing to talk about. I have alopecia areata universalis.
Right.
The only hair I have on my body are eyebrows.
How did you manage to keep the eyebrows?
Painful steroid injections.
Oh dear.
Which, by the way, I would recommend if anyone ever comes to offer you injections in your eyebrow, or one time I let one of my friends in residence talked me into getting my eyelid injected for eyelashes.
Oh.
Even though it's a 30 gauge needle, so this is like the smallest needle you can inject stuff with, like an insulin syringe, for example.
Uh-huh.
Highly recommend not doing that.
Wow. 2 out of 10 would not repeat. Would not do it again.
I'm trying to think.
I am convinced that the eyelid injection is actually a form of torture.
So so the effects of the steroid are local. They have to put them right where you want the hair to grow.
Yeah, and if they don't like alternate the places where they do it, I get like patches. You can see where they injected.
Mm. I'd rather wear an eyebrow wigs.
Eyebrow wigs.
Tiny eyebrow wigs.
I haven't tried it yet, but we'll see, I guess.
This could be...
If I get tired of it.
This could be my money-making idea. we'll model them after... We'll model them after Mark's.
But I think...
Mark's eyebrows.
You have nice eyebrows.
Which he has lovely eyebrows.
I agree.
I think it's one of my best features
this
in my
This is
going
to be a go-to topic fit. For
so
the
So do you,
podcast.
Amy.
I hope we don't.
I don't
it.
Like my eyebrows.
I think... I think it makes sense. You have less surface area for bacteria and oils and things like that to get on when there's no hair there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know.
I don't think it would allow basis. One to become odor free. It would just, you know.
No, I'm certainly not odor free.
That's all I was saying. I wasn't saying anything different. I was merely positing that it's not going to completely remove those issues.
Well, I'm glad that we had such an attentive listener.
Yes.
Who got back to us.
Yes.
Anonymous listener
who we have no idea who it is.
Feedback is great.
Yes, it is. I've got another listener comment. This one from an Iowa PharmD, doctor of pharmacology, named Tony. Tony has a book out called Memorizing Pharmacology, A Relaxed Approach, which sounds nice, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the epilogue...
do you take opioids before you start studying, or what?
I don't know. And in the epilogue, he wrote a rather harrowing story about the birth of his preemie triplets 4 years ago, before 28 weeks gestation. Here's a little excerpt from the audiobook version that sort of sets the stage for his question.
The haze of the policeman, the paramedics, my wife, my future life without my daughter... My life with my daughter, an infant in the back of the ambulance, the minutes before the one-hour surgery to correct, the pediatric surgeon's enormous hands, the surgeon's baritone words. There will be no problems, he said. But there will be no problems.
So, with that in mind, here's Tony's question.
I was curious how your group would get to the point in their career that they could say to a parent, there will be no problems. As an advisor, I see many pre-med students, and confidence/persistence is the one trait I wish I could give them.
Julie doesn't know that I run any written comments or questions I receive through a text-to-speech processor, but it's just how I roll. So Tony's question has to do with a couple of things, I think. One is the confidence that one gets from accumulating knowledge. But also, I think... to some extent, the art of reassurance, mm-hmm. and reassuring people. And you're told that, you know, I read an article recently by an NHS doc about the art of reassurance, and he suggests that the phrase that you read all the time in textbooks is reassure the patient. And that's, he thinks that should be just removed because from textbooks, because that's that advice is so unspecific, and there is an art to it. What do you guys think of that? Have you ever been particularly proud of your ability to reassure somebody, or
never thought about it like that?
I feel like it's an important part of being at least a primary care physician, if not every physician. You know,
I think what this question comes down to is experience, mm-hmm. and kind of having this, you know, acquired knowledge over years of practice that you do have control of a situation, and you can kind of see whether or not it's like an acute, like a dire situation or not. So for me, hearing the physician say that was from experience, like speaking from experience of children that have PDAs and get rushed in. And
PDA is that, is what
it's a patent ductus arteriovenous.
Yeah.
So it's a,
it's like a hole in your heart or aorta or something like that, right?
Well, yeah, kind of, yeah.
Connection between
you can
vessels.
Educate me.
It stays open and instead of closing like it normally does. Right. One second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, this physician is clearly very experienced. But
It sounds like a surgeon. I wonder if it was a surgeon.
It sounds like the pediatric surgeon.
Yeah.
So if this person was here, then I'm imagining who might have said that. I won't name any names, but I would believe it too.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, this isn't a big deal in their mind. You know, I'm thinking about exactly the same thing. Actually, my dad is in heart surgery right now as we speak.
Oh my gosh.
And for me, this harrowing, you know, but for the heart surgeon that is replacing his aortic valve and changing, fixing this aneurysm, and he did a bypass as well. That is like his everyday, you know. That is his day to day thing, and so he looks at that and he goes, "Okay, you know, I've done this before," and I think especially part of surgery, especially surgery and things that are sort of procedural. They have that element to it. And I think it comes down to exactly what Amy said.
Mm-hmm.
Like experience, having the experience of knowing what to do, you know, in the situation, I think really gives you the leg up on that. And I think to address more directly, was it Tony's mm-hmm. question?
Yeah.
You know, how do you tell, you know, a pre-med how to be confident or things like that? That's difficult. It's the same problem as you know, reassure the patient. It's sort of like telling someone, pay attention. Like, if they could pay attention, they probably would.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Or don't worry. Tell someone don't worry and see how well that works. You
right,
know?
Right.
Like, just be better. Just be better at this. but I think to address that, like, what you need, you know, is to really know yourself and to know your you know, sort of know your own boundaries, know your own comfort level. And how you do that is interesting and up for debate and interpretation and discussion.
Well, I think some people, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, I think some people sort of seem like they're born with confidence and, mm-hmm. and you know, so there's a bit of temperament there. At least they have confidence that whatever they need to learn, they will learn it in time for them to need it, sort of confidence. And then there's the confidence that comes, just as you say, comes with years of experience and all that kind of stuff. What do you think, Julie? Are you born with confidence?
I definitely was not, but it's something I'm working on. And I do agree that it has to do with experience, and being in medicine can be frightening. Because you don't want to say the wrong thing. You don't want to falsely reassure somebody. And I think in that article we read, there was a discussion about young physicians versus experienced physicians and how I kind of obviously relate to the younger physicians who they go by the textbook. And I'm confident with what the textbook says, but in terms of what experience tells you, there's a lot to build on.
Yeah, so she's referring to that article by the NHS doc, and, mm-hmm. and basically the he or she, I can't remember, drew the distinction between, you know, relatively inexperienced doctors versus experienced doctors, and how they tend to reassure differently. You know,
mm-hmm.
young inexperienced doctors tend to rely on their knowledge,
right.
their book knowledge, and then mm-hmm. older people who've done it for a long time have the ability to sort of integrate all that knowledge and they just know what they're and they can mm-hmm. be like, you know what, chill, I got this.
Mm-hmm. So maybe there's no solution. Maybe it just is like a evolution of, you know, your experience with practicing medicine.
Yeah, there's other kinds of reassurance too, though, or other kinds of confidence that you can project. I would think, like, You can provide reassurance through your confidence by saying things like by basically, I don't know, like cognitive reassurance versus affective reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like
yes,
some people need information. You know, my wife is a classic example. You know, when things are going wrong, she needs information. She does a lot of research. She seeks out information. I tend to be more avoidant myself, but that's just me. And then there are other people maybe like me who need effective reassurance. Basically, like, I got this. You're cool. I am here to help you. I'm going to do whatever needs to be mm-hmm. done. Whereas she wants to know all of the intricate details and things like that. And knowing when to supply those two things.
I just spent 2 weeks on the NICU.
Yeah.
And one thing that they, like, if parents start to get really anxious, they always just say, we've done this a lot of many times before. And then that helps calm them down. And it's actually true. The majority of the babies on the floor have had, like, the same procedure or similar procedure. And just the parents knowing that this is not some sort of anomaly that's never been addressed before mm-hmm. is helpful.
I think that is a really appropriate approach to tell somebody, we've done this a million times, but at the same time, you don't want to undermine somebody's fear, and you want to address the fact that they are scared and let them know that their fear is valid. You know, don't just say, oh, this is nothing, we've done this a million times. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that it's nothing. It's that if there are complications that come from it, we have the infrastructure to address it.
Mm-hmm.
They're foreseeable. The idea of clinical course and saying, we've gone down this road, we've gone down the possible alternate paths that this road may lead us to, mm-hmm. and we're prepared for each of them. I think there's an affective, kind of a blend of both, cognitive and affective, that
as a student, it made me feel better, because I was kind of like, I don't know what we're going to do.
especially when we're at the beginning of the road and we haven't done those.
And when the doc's like, oh, you know, I'm like, okay, good.
So I think we're kind of dancing around one of the things that I wanted to say to address this, and it's part of this is a big part of this, and a big part of that surgeon being able to say exactly what that patient needed, the patient's parent needed to hear, was being able to identify with the person, empathize with the person, identify what their fear was based on,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. So if it's fear of the unknown, saying, you know, this is routine. You know, I know this is very scary to you, but I've done this 1,000 times, literally, might help, right? Versus, like, fear that you're not competent, right? That's not going to address the fear. Like, if someone doesn't believe I'm competent, me saying I've done this 1,000 times is not going to address mm-hmm. that, right? So you have to figure out what it is that they're afraid of, or at least get some semblance of an understanding of what their concern really centers around, and then address it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I don't know how teachable that is. I suspect that it can be taught. And I suspect, you know, some people are better at it than others in terms of, like, identifying where that other person is coming from, identifying their emotion, and then responding appropriately. But I think that's probably the biggest key factor in being able to do that, is sort of matching the response to that person's concern.
Mm-hmm.
I was and I'll post this article because I keep referring to it
mm-hmm.
On the show notes at shortcode.com. But I kind of like the additional discussion in that article about the kinds of reassurance and that is provided by things like things that you may not notice, like things like dress and environment, mm-hmm. decor even. He mentioned acoustics in the article, which I thought was interesting. I'm not really sure exactly what that meant.
Like if your voice is like echoing off the walls or something?
Yeah, like or something about that.
I think there's like gentle music playing and it's like nicely heard down the hall.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Some nice music.
Are you in a shuffling environment where people are moving quickly and things are falling and there's lots of sounds and it doesn't sound organized versus, you know what I mean?
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
So picture, one of the things I remember hearing too was the idea of a teacher, a good versus bad teacher. The teacher that yells and looks like an authoritative figure and is shouting left and right and screaming things out, that might not be a control situation versus a person that can express urgency in a soft voice.
Right.
The idea of, I understand your intensity, but your level of control as well.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think really typifies this is if you look at in the hospital when there's a code, depending on where you are, when there's a code, and how that situation gets handled can vary extremely widely. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I was on a floor, and I took part in leading a code on a patient. And I guess they just, the attendings there were like, oh, he seems like he's got it handled. He'll,
wow.
We'll just stand over here.
Well, but I think part of it was, you know, working and facilitating the communication of other people. You know, so it's not like I'm standing there being the boss or mm-hmm. something. It was just that I was helping to coordinate, you know, the decision making of people who knew this patient, people who were checking pulses and doing CPR, things like that. And the way that that room looked versus when we got the patient up to the ICU and the ICU attending kind of walks in and he can see very clearly that, you know, things are a little flustered. So very quickly adjusts to calmly asking just yes or no questions, mm-hmm. calmly asking, you know, sort of simple, very, very easy, you know, and it's very amazing to see what those different environments look mm-hmm. like.
Projecting an attitude of like, calm, we have this.
Yes.
And it's amazing.
Need some information.
And yes. We'll... You also, as a medical student, get an opportunity to see trauma call on mm-hmm. surgery. And so seeing how those are run under varying circumstances is very interesting as well. Some, you know, can really run the spectrum between like, this is utterly controlled and really incredible sort of well-oiled machinery to sort of a hot mess. Mm. And seeing why, I mean, the reasons that those go well is a very real thing. And how you teach that is very interesting, because how you make a good team work together is, it's definitely one of those things that has like a lot of talk. There's a lot of talk, you know, a lot of people write like corporate mythology books on how to be a good leader. Mm-hmm. You know, there's probably thousands. Like, all you have to do is next time you're in an airport, right? Next time you're in an airport, go to the bookstore. Look at the five books they have out front. It's all like Leadership 101, The Leader Academy, you know, all of like Leadativity. And, you know, this is what these books are, you know, and it's because it's like this is their market audience, you know, the professional businessman traveler. You know, if you're next time you're in O'Hare or whatever, you seriously, like 3 out of 5 of those books will be that. One will be a Danielle Steele novel.
Yes.
And then, and yeah, anyway. But that's really interesting, you know, because it's one of those things that there really is a methodology. There really is a way to teach this. And I can see it, but I don't really know what it is. And so, but I know lots of people talk about it. And I know, you know, that there's like lots of sketchy pseudoscience about it.
Are you guys familiar with process engineering?
No.
No.
So it's the idea of looking at individuals, and there's studies of saying, all right, we're going to look at every aspect of a production as if it were kind of like a manufacturing business, but apply that to human resources and saying effective leaders, where things tend to, and it's hard to quantify those types of factors, why do things seem like a well-oiled machine when this individual's in charge but not when this other individual is? So going through and really logging every action they do, creating kind of a model for that, and then applying it to other individuals and seeing which things drop out, and then having them incorporating it and seeing if there's a change. I know they do that for larger corporate structures, mm-hmm. and it tends to work pretty well in mid-level management. The thing is, you're dealing with the same people every time in a very predictable situation. I think in medicine, where personalities,
right.
variability, a lot of unknowns in terms of medical history, it's not as applicable, but there is a science to it. I think there is, and there's room for improvement.
That's really fascinating to me, because there is, yeah, there's like, look at the aviation industry. Mm-hmm. They've spent an enormous amount of time and effort, and they're extraordinarily good at teaching pilots, teaching air traffic controllers, teaching, you know, sort of coordinating these things and working on the sort of communication and interpersonal mm-hmm. sort of skills training. But yeah, there is this weird interface, like in medicine, and you know, I've seen things go well. Like, it's sort of a practical intelligence. Mm-hmm. That's sort of that thing that people say, like, street smarts.
Yes.
Like, one of the most awe-inspiring moments that I've had was working with a firefighter. He was the guy in charge on a scene when I was a paramedic. And he just had this really incredible practical intelligence. And he was very able to communicate it. You know, I was sort of setting up my station to do rehab for the firefighters, which is, so as they fight fires, they get very hot.
Oh.
They sweat a lot. They can overheat. They can die of dehydration.
Sure, sure.
Things like that. It's very scary, right? So every once in a while, they'll come out of the firefighting zone and we'll give them basically like a bag of normal saline and put them in a chair that has like cooled water running through it. So to just like drop their temperature back. And I was setting it up and he kind of pulls me aside just very calmly. And he's like, don't put it there. No. Like that wall over there, like 60 feet away or maybe even more than that, like 50, 100, almost 100 yards. And he's like, that wall there is gonna blow out in about 90 minutes.
Thank you for telling me.
And you're not gonna die there, but you're gonna get showered in glass
in 90 minutes.
Yep. Yeah, or something. You know, it was to that effect. And it was pretty close. You know, it was 70 minutes or something like that. You know, but it was like, that's exactly what happened, you know, and he was sort of looking at the situation sort of holistically, integrating all of this information. And part of it's that experience and part of it's like the right demeanor, like the right person for the right job. It's sort of very self-selecting, mm-hmm. like firefighting, very self-selecting. But these things all kind of come together as a confluence and you get to see these things really play out, and it was just fascinating seeing that kind of practical intelligence bring it together in that moment.
I think the last part you just said though about like kind of having an honesty with your personality type and knowing what you would actually be really good at one day versus not is also really important. I don't know.
It mm-hmm. may be relevant mm-hmm. to Tony's question. I mean, in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, confidence.
I think, yeah. Amy, like, you probably can't be more right, right?
Well, so, I mean, even with these, God, I had another PBA, and I'm so, like, just so awkward with them. And
this
blah,
is
blah,
the
blah.
Performance-based assessment that, you know, that with the actors playing patients.
It's, you know, and then I got the feedback from it, and it was like, some of it was like, you know, when you looked at me like this, I really felt like you cared, which is great. But I also think that's just basic, intuitive, like human empathy, social skills that you either have or you don't have, and I don't know how you can teach that. And yeah, I'm good at it.
Can you demonstrate that look for me, please? I know this is podcast, so it's
there it is.
Throw the brow.
Perfect.
Drop the shoulders.
Yes.
Cock the head to the left 15 degrees. I mean,
you can
see,
teach
we've
it.
We've just learned
like,
it.
No. But it's like slowly, I don't think as if on a boat. As people slowly discover, this guy's really manipulative.
Well, no, but I think I feel
I often feel reassured around you, Mark. Now I know why.
I often feel almost like part of me is sad that they're having to watch for that and give feedback on that, because it's part of being human.
But I think though that it's possible to feel empathy,
mm-hmm.
but not show it well.
Mm-hmm. Did you see these eyes? Come on. I'm showing it.
I felt your empathy right there. I'm not questioning your empathy. I'm just saying that there might be some people out there who, you know, they may understand what the patient is going through, but maybe they don't project it well enough. They may be too reserved. They may be, you know, just not. We all know people who just seem to have no facial expression, and mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily mean that.
So they should go into anesthesia?
Well, it makes me wonder about myself, because like I didn't really realize it until a good bit, you know, of the way into medical.
That's why you're so interested in keeping your eyebrows, because you need them.
I have like almost crippling social anxiety in certain situations, but I'm also like a very pro-social person. Like, I'm one of the most like sociotropically driven people that I know. This is like what most people say, what most people mean when they say extrovert,
right?
Like someone who like needs the interaction of other people to like drive their life.
I think I'm going to start using the word sociotropic if you don't
mind. Yeah, I am. So I am like the most sociotropically driven person that I know. And, but yet I have this like very crippling social anxiety, and like, so those PBAs, like I've done things like I've run cardiac arrests. I've like taken people who were dead on a floor and was telling, you know, 15 other people, you know, or whatever to do, what to do, and taken them to the hospital, you know, and played a part in saving their life. And yet I walk into this room with a simulated patient and like my heart stops, you know, and I'm the one who's going to need CPR, right? Like,
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Yes.
There's something very weird and sort of magical about that situation that really like F's with your head. So I was really excited to hear that like the AMA voted recently to say like, we don't believe it's necessary. But I did want to talk about something that Amy brought up, like that sort of personality thing, because I think when people, like, I've talked with people and they're trying to decide like what they want to do in medicine, I think that is the most interesting thing to go back to. Like, if you really know yourself and you know like what kind of person you are, like, I'm very sociotropically driven, but I also have like a very visual memory. I love that sort of shoot from the hip sort of visual interpretation, which puts me at odds, because that's like really good for things like pathology and radiology. But I'm so sociotropically driven, I want to talk to patients. I want to talk to, you know, families. I want to talk to, you know, lots of colleagues and things like that. So knowing these things about yourself can really help push you in a direction that I think is a good fit for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you know that you don't like that kind of, you know, very interpersonally interactive and very sort of high pressure type situations, like, do not go into emergency medicine, right? You know, it's like things like knowing that, because I think those are probably the most immutable characteristics of who we are. Whereas, like, you know, the data shows that people are satisfied with their job when they're good at it. That's like the best predictor of whether they like their job or not, is are they good at it? And people get good at stuff they stick with. You know, that's sort of the 10,000 hours thing. If you keep doing it, you're going to get good at it. And you're not going to keep doing something that you're not sort of suited for, right? If I come to work every day and I'm like, I don't like these people, I don't fit in with these people, you know, like, I'm going to have a hard time doing 10,000 hours worth of it to build the experience or whatever, you know, so that I can be good at it. So that's, you know, I'm following the arrows back, and it just says sort of know yourself, mm-hmm, and pick the thing that you know.
So what are you going to do?
Well, for me, that's pediatrics.
Okay.
Yeah. Talk to, I like, there's nothing I want to do more in the world than to talk to scared, worried parents about their sick kid, you know, and then treat the sick kid.
Going back to the clip of the audiobook, it kind of cut off abruptly for me, and I wasn't sure if he was reassured by the doctor saying yes.
Okay. I think he was.
He was. Okay. It just...
That was...
It ended, and I thought, personally, I don't think that would have been reassuring to me. I would have been like, okay, you're being cocky, and
well,
I don't know.
Well, what you... you know, I wasn't going to play the whole clip because it's the whole thing, because it's 8 minutes long or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, so this guy, he has medical knowledge. Yes. You know, he understands all of the different things that can happen, all of the different things that are happening with his, you know, preemie triplets.
Uh-huh.
You know, he knows what PDA is. He knows, you know, he knows all this. Is that the right
thing? Yes.
Mm-hmm. You could say any three letters.
It's true.
It'll mean something.
He knows what all these things are. He understands the implications. He doesn't. Okay. He may not necessarily need reassurance on a cognitive level.
Okay.
You know, because he's got that information.
He needed the...
So that was my read.
All right.
Of his thing, but right.
So that's going to be you, John, reassuring people, telling them There will be no problems.
There will be
like
no
I said,
problem.
You know, that's why you have to make that match. You have to look and go.
Someone might punch you in the face.
Yeah, you got to figure out what they need.
Oh, there's a problem. Yeah,
have to say it in a Ben Kingsley accent.
Yeah, I was in the pediatric surgery clinic with a physician, and I watched them just amazingly. See what the parents, see what the family, the way they were postured, the kinds of questions they were asking, the way they were asking them sort of pointedly, you know, and I knew because we had talked previously about how you manage appendicitis in children, that you can conservatively manage it. And so, you know, the physician was saying, this is something I can offer, you know, if parents are going to have close follow-up and they're going to come back and they're going to, you know, really watch the kid. And if the kid gets sick for any, you know, sort of any really long period of time, they need to be taken to the hospital. Or I can just offer them, let's cut it out. Let's take this kid to surgery, you know. And so they took the surgeon, just sort of integrated and said, okay, this family needs that option. And just made the decision. And yeah, it's a little paternalistic.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
But sometimes you have to sort of make that decision when to say, like, well, in this case, it's paternalistic to say, I'm going to only offer you the surgery rather than offer you the conservative option. But in their mind, that would be a mismatch, right? That would be a greater risk to the patient because the family may not, you know, really be acutely aware enough of their child's status to prevent them from getting a, you know, a septic acute abdomen when their appendix ruptured.
There was an article, I forgot where I read it. I know it's referenced in Atul Gawande's most recent book, but that wasn't the original place I read it. But it's basically looking at the three models of, like, doctoring, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. But the paternalistic, this is what you need and we're going to do it and there's no discussion, versus on the other side of the spectrum, pure information giving, which is overwhelming sometimes, this is all novel to me and you've seen 1,000 of these cases. And then kind of the midpoint in between of saying, kind of like what this pediatrician did, of assessing what resources do you have now? What is realistic for your family's needs? What are you willing and not willing to do? And based on that, this is what I would suggest. This is where I would head. And kind of not coercing.
Shared decision making.
Yeah, sharing them, leading them towards what you think would be the ideal choice. Mm-hmm. I think there's a cool skill in that.
You give out a lot of information. You can give out a lot of information in an interaction with a patient, and depending on how acute things are for that patient, I imagine that information can just go in one ear and out the other. Because all you can think about is, I mean, I've experienced this, you know, you latch onto a detail, as a patient, you latch onto a detail and then you can't let go of that one detail and you miss everything else for, you know, a couple of minutes. And then maybe you come back to the conversation and now there's just more detail coming at you. And, you know, when you're frightened, that's how your brain works. In other words, not well, you can't process information in that situation. So you've got to be able to read your patients too, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I still think that it's important to connect with them at their level and address their fears and, you know, give them a hug if they need it and then tell them what's going to happen.
I was she's kinda, sweet. I'm glad she's here.
I was surprised actually on my peds clerkship how often I did not see clinicians saying what they would do. Like,
what do you mean?
They'd always say, like, there's some options, and then, like, we'll leave you to decide, rather than being like, you know, like, I was just surprised there was less of, like, yeah, you know, you could do this, you know, if it were my kid, I'd probably do this. Hmm. There was less of that than I thought I would see.
Do you think that would be a good idea? Is that what you're...
I don't know if it's a good idea or not, but I think if I had been the doctor, I probably would have said, oh, I'd probably do this.
Well, I heard them say, all the pediatricians say, well, the parents know their kid better than I do, you know. So I think that was a lot of negotiating what would be the best decision. But I agree with you. I mean,
it was just an observation that I had.
Well, all right. Are you guys ready to
go on vacation?
Okay. Are you guys ready to jump on the bandwagon of eating parasites?
Sure.
Does that sound like a good idea to you? I read that Lisa Weir pointed out this New York Times article about people who are basically experimenting on themselves with parasites in order to cure certain conditions like colitis and and things like that. There apparently is a burgeoning world of people swallowing parasites donated by other people in order to cure their...
They're not donated.
...their conditions. What?
You have to pay for them.
Oh.
They're not donated.
No. Oh, I didn't yeah, catch that.
They can be pretty pricey.
Really?
Yeah.
What...
We priced out a couple before the show. Behind your back, Dave.
Did you?
We were debating.
Well, I wouldn't drink that coffee we picked up for you.
It's not just coffee.
Well,
are the parasites?
I think this is really fascinating. Like, it takes that sort of microbiome thing that's really sort of buzzing, and it sort of brings it to the next level because. So there was a really fascinating article I read recently about, I think it was called Why Your Cat is Making You Crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about, how the toxoplasmosis parasite is so exquisitely evolved that it, can change the behavior of those that it infects. And there's this scientist, maybe it was the Czech Republic or something. He did a whole bunch of research into people when they were or weren't infected with this parasite. And there's for example, in humans, there's gender differences. So in women who are infected with this parasite, they become more outgoing, more social, more interpersonally interactive, more trusting. When men get infected with this parasite,
sounds all right.
When men get infected with this parasite, they become more aloof, more paranoid, more likely to distrust an individual.
I think I know quite a few guys who are infected.
And
Julie's dated some.
And again, the argument isn't that it's necessarily a night and day difference, but if you take 100 people, and you give them the test for this parasite, and then you give them sort of personality inventories, you can actually find these gender differences, and they're statistically significant.
I feel like you just went way existential on us. let's take a few steps back. Okay,
we're going there, Amy.
But you can. But the idea that infection, a very subclinical infection with this brain parasite that just insists itself in your brain and just chills out.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not the host. We're not the primary host for this. It wants to get back to the cat.
Mm-hmm.
So anywhere that it can just chill out for a while.
While it waits for your cat.
While it gets to the correct environment. It has, these very weird strategies. And there's so much of microbiology that is context dependent like that. Like E. coli, it normally lives in your colon, but it has this whole array of genes where it's mm-hmm. oh, I'm not in a colon, I'm now in this watery environment, okay, now I'm going to express flagella and start swimming. I'm going to swim upstream. And so now it's in your urinary tract, right? And now it swims upstream and it goes, well, now I'm not in your urethra anymore. I'm in your bladder. So I'm going to express these little pili things and I'm going to attach to the
anchor.
Wall and anchor in.
Really?
Yes.
And
they're smart.
It's freaking brilliant, right?
Wow.
And here it is. It's just tiny little gram-negative bacteria.
So let's bring this back, though, to... let's bring this back to the people who are, desperate for medical help. They're unable to get it, basically, by tradition... Or they feel mm-hmm. unable to get it by traditional medicine, so they are swallowing...
I have a...
What are they swallowing?
Helminth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is there a specific...
Yeah, there's different species that they use. I have a couple comments. The first
Good.
One is, the article that we read that you shared with us before the show, there was no talk about Remicade, which is an anti-TNF-alpha. It's a biologic, agent. It has side effects and other things that accompany it, but it often can put these IBD diseases, especially like ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, in remission. So I'm kind of wondering why that was never something they tried.
So my impression from the article is that these are people who maybe have tried things.
It didn't list that, though. It said he tried like prednisone, which is horrible because it gives you all the, it makes you feel like crap. And then mesalamine, which is a
stalic,
which yeah. And they didn't mention Remicade.
Hmm.
So that was the first thing that kind of gave me pause. The second thing is whenever there are, you know, individuals trying to empirically like treat themselves because they feel like conventional medicine is failing them, for every one success, there's probably like 10,000 situations in which that can be really counterproductive and harmful.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, in the article it said, you know, well, you know, physicians, they seem to be kind of wary about endorsing it. Well, of course, because anything that a clinician is going to have to endorse needs to be controlled. So you don't even have any quality standards for what these patients are accessing and what they're taking, so they can't be endorsed by a clinician. It sounds like there are some clinical trials and studies that are underway that could maybe demonstrate whether or not this should be an option for patients, what type of patient, what type of helmet, like, you know, what, like, you know, but until that's actually in place, of course, like, a clinician can't endorse it because we do evidence-based medicine.
Right. But what do you do for a patient for whom you've exhausted? I mean, let's disregard this particular thing. You know, there are occasions where you will get to the end of the line, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to do.
You know, I mean, that's a good question.
There will be problems.
But this is the...
What's his name?
Like Job?
No, okay. Like the mind-body medicine guy from Harvard.
John Kabat-Zinn.
Like, so he took chronic pain patients. There is no cure for this pain.
Right.
And they did like mental health type things to where you could just kind of like learn to live with your condition. I'm not saying that you need to send everybody who has an untreatable condition to like a therapist, but I'm saying that, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm going to stop there.
this reminded me of Steve Jobs, right? So Steve Jobs kind of forgave taking like chemotherapy and went straight to like acupuncture
alternative
and stuff,
yeah,
right? And,
but,
and
yeah,
so it's sort of like, okay, once we've we want to make sure we've exhausted the possibilities, yeah. But then that's where it gets interesting, and that's where I can see that people have frustrations with, you know, sort of traditional medicine, because of the reluctance to explore some of these things. But I can also see why, like, many physicians go, yeah, I'm not really comfortable with your, you know, acupuncture therapy for your pancreatic cancer. And so because of the fact that it's so, like, uncontrolled...
I mean, acupuncture, I think it's one of those things that is, it's a control. Like, there's a practitioner, they use sterile needles and stuff like that. And, like, our therapies for pancreatic cancer right now are horrible. So I feel like
right,
it wouldn't
so
hurt. And also, acupuncture
quickly
is often affordable. So the thing I worry about with patients who are, you know, really vulnerable, they don't have options, is that they might, you know, spend $2,500 on parasites in Tijuana that maybe they couldn't have afforded to get.
Sure.
That they could have gotten for free in Tijuana by drinking the water.
Right. No. Or have a friend crap in a jar.
I don't know. I do, like, when my mom was sick with cancer, I had, like, I tried to protect her from, like, friends that were trying to help her out by saying, oh,
yeah,
like,
she should
eat, you know,
mm-hmm,
this berry from Brazil. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, I'm familiar with that berry because, like, we eat it sometimes in Brazil. And it's just I worry about...
quackery?
Yeah.
essentially, it's the idea of taking like spurious correlations and really like pushing them to like, no, this is therapy, which I get the, I get when there's no other options. There's a difference between like leaving conventional medicine and exhausting conventional medicine.
Right.
And I think the discussion I would have with someone are two very different things, because I have IBS. I just got diagnosed and I finally, you know, have a name for what's bothering me. Later, doc, you've done your job. I'm going to go explore everything else versus, all right, so what have you seen? You know, can we look back at going back to the evidence-based stuff and what works? Let's try all that. If there's nothing else, well, consider the costs and the harm and the possibility, and that's a very different discussion.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to close this show out.
Oh,
all right. Yeah, she's like, Julie's like, that is abrupt. Rude.
I feel like I just got here.
No, it's great because we get to go on vacation. Well, after our shelf exam, we get to go on our week-long vacation.
We have our test in 5 minutes.
Like 5 minutes.
Here we go. Oh, Toxo.
Wait, where are you going on vacation? Quick.
I'm going to Maine.
Okay, and are you going on vacation?
I'm going to Minneapolis this weekend. Mm-hmm. See Alex Knezovich in a play. He was a former student here, and he's playing Gaston in Beauty and the Beast.
He dropped out of med school.
Yep.
Oh, right. That, yes.
Yeah, that's
you told
awesome.
Me about that.
That's
really
awesome.
Excited to see him.
Fantastic. Well, just like that, we're out. Thanks so much for hanging out with us today, listeners. If you like what you hear, go to iTunes, whether you use iTunes or not. Give us a review because they help us grow the show. We're listening all over the place. Go to theshortcoat.com/tell us and find out how to get in touch with us. Show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College Medicine Student Government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by Agrafox. Talk to you in 1 week.